Welcome to this session of the Futures Forum. This year, all our sessions are asking what sort of a future are we creating for Australians in 2040? Our theme today is where Australians will live. And our guest is Mary Casey, who's the chair of the Australian branch of the Living Future Institute based here in Sydney. Mary has nearly 20 years of design and construction industry experience in Australia and internationally. She made Australia her home over a decade ago, having grown up in the USA. Mary says she's continually inspired by the uniqueness and beauty of the world's ecosystems and Australia's ecosystems. She's worked as an architect, sustainability consultant, project manager, trainer, and facilitator. In all of her work, she questions what's possible, challenging and supporting her clients to pursue loftier sustainability aspirations than they thought they could achieve. Mary's director at McLaughlin Lister, a project management and management consulting firm based here in Sydney. So Mary, welcome. And how will we live in 2040?
Thank you, Charles, for that introduction, and hello, everyone. Thanks for coming tonight. I'd actually like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to any Aboriginal people who are with us tonight. I've been asked to talk to you about trends in housing and how we're making choices about where we live and how the housing market is going to respond to that. And I think I might be taking this question in a slightly different direction than you expect, but I hope you'll come with me on the journey. So when we talk about where we live, I don't think it's so much a question of whether we will choose the suburbs or the CBD. We will choose to live in places that enable us not to just live, but to thrive. And I'm thinking I should probably start by saying that as a part of an organization called the International Living Future Institute, we very much believe in a positive future. That's a hopeful future where we've reconnected with our relationship to the ecosystems we inhabit, and that connection is so healthy and robust that we are in that sort of state of thriving. So that's on the wall there, our mission, who we are. We are about leading the transformation towards a future that is socially just, culturally rich, and ecologically restorative. And the Living Future of Australia, as Charles said, is a chapter of the International Institute, and we administer a number of programs, including the Living Building Challenge, the Living Community Challenge, the Living Product Challenge, Declare, Just, and Reveal, which are intended to address all scales and everything through the supply chain of development. So we're not trying to affect, anything entrenched or big or, not trying to fundamentally reshape anything. So, it'll take a while. I think our architecture, and having an architecture background myself, it's kind of the largest mechanism by which we express our ideas about who we think we are. We want our architecture to reflect our best selves. And there's nothing really more personal than our habitation. And what I think is interesting is that model has not changed all that much in many thousands of years. There's this sort of a basic kind of form, paradigm for places that we live in. But there are some key differences that I think we'll see in the next two decades that we really actually need to see in the next two decades with regard to how our homes reflect our values in relation to our ecosystems. And as we all know, housing in particularly this part of Australia is very expensive, and it's probably the single biggest investment any of us will ever make in our lifetimes. And so it's a difficult process to choose. And when my husband and I were looking for places to live, we had a very practical list of all the characteristics we wanted. He wanted a garage for his cars and his tools and things, and we wanted two bedrooms, and we wanted a backyard for a garden, and blah, blah, blah. All very practical stuff. But when we looked at all of the places that actually met those criteria, there were some that were clearly not it, and some that actually sort of resonated with us. And it's kind of like, why were some of those places speaking to us and others weren't. And I think it's because you're not just thinking about a place to keep your stuff. You're talking about a place that you will call home. So I think it's kind of important to talk about that for a second. And that's a word that we understand innately, but apply narrowly. It's a word that has a certain sacredness about it, but it's become sort of cheapened and co-opted and spun. It's a powerful word to think about what it means to be home, to just kind of maybe sit with that for a second and think about what's going through your mind when I say that word. There's an expansiveness to it, but there's also an intimacy. I think of a lot of different things. I think of my mother's kitchen. I'm from Texas, by the way. I think of the smell of smoked brisket, which was usually my dad's doing rather than my mother's. I also think of huge expanse of blue sky and high fluffy clouds, because Texas is fairly flat, kind of like Australia. I think of the company of my friends. I think of their accents. It's not really a place. It's sort of a state of being. It's an emotional thing. And conversely, you can live in a place and have it not be your home. Outdoors is part of home. Home is what you love. It extends far beyond your front door. It can include a number of places. It can include this or this. In traditional cultures, the place you come from, the land you come from, is part of how you define yourself. Indigenous Australians will ask you when they first meet you if you're a freshwater person or a saltwater person, because they're trying to figure you out. Home includes familiarity and memory, an occasion, an emotional response. A place can stop being home with too much time in between visits. And I think where I'm sort of heading is that we are potentially very important to this planet. And right now, I think there's a degree of disconnection between the idea of that as our home. And you know, in our minds, we don't necessarily think of that. And when that disconnection exists, both we suffer and the land suffers. And it's not that we're inherently bad. We've sort of kind of forgotten. One of the key people involved in the founding of the Living Future Institute, sort of indirectly, is Janine Benyus. She's a biologist who founded the science of biomimicry. And I'm just going to quote her kind of at length, not really at length, a few sentences. So Janine says, "The boundary between us and the rest of the natural world is a false one that dissolves when you consider what is really important, what makes life worth living. We are part and parcel of this blue-green planet. It's our home, and it's where we belong. And now it's time, with the help of our extraordinary planet mates, to start putting down roots." So this science of biomimicry is based on the idea that we should use nature as model, measure, and mentor, and that in so doing, we can apply nature's design solutions to human problems, which is great from an R&D perspective, since, you know, nature's been perfecting things for quite a long time. But it also affords us a really important emotional and psychological opportunity to reconnect with this idea of ourselves as belonging here and being a part of this. And when you think like a planet mate, like a species that belongs in this interconnected system, you start asking different questions. So instead of how can I be less bad, you think, how can I integrate with this place? What do I have to contribute? What can I offer? So it's important for us to think about whether or not we want to reclaim this role, if we want to re-embrace this role, because it promises, I think, a great deal of healing and beauty and thriving, but it comes with responsibility, comes with a need to change. Because unfortunately, the direction that we've given to the housing market so far has resulted in a lot of this. And this is an answer. Yes, urbanized humanity is a way of going about things, but is it the best answer? Do places like this feed our souls? Do they resonate with us? Do we thrive in them, or do we just survive? And even if we do decide that this is a model we want to perpetuate, we're facing humanity's bottleneck, and it's coming up hard. And so we're going to have to make some pretty tough choices over the next 3 or 4 decades. And for 200,000 years, we lived one way, and for 2 or 3 generations, we've been doing this, and we've seen some pretty spectacular results, not altogether great ones. So what if we said that connection to nature was really important to us? What if we said that we want to find the next way? So it's not to go back to the way we did it 200,000 years ago, but to find a better way forward that gives us places where we can be a force for good, that support us in our embrace of our role as steward, where we unpipe streams and we rebuild wetlands and we bring life back to this place and we act as though every place was sacred enough to be given the designation home. And we're going to get what we've always got unless we change what we're asking for. And so the next question I'm supposed to talk about is how the housing market will respond, and I think they will respond precisely on what we tell them we value. So if we say that, yes, connection to nature is an important part of our mental health and survival, there's a whole science of neurobiophilia that's emerging around this, that when you show people, even if you just show people pictures of natural patterns, there are things that happen in their brains that are very positive and very important. And secondly, that observing and valuing nature is a deeply healing thing for us socially and psychologically, but it's also instructive. So from a problem-solving, biomimetic sort of point of view, there's good reason to pay attention to how nature solves problems. And that inspiration from and connection to nature are really important requirements for us as individuals and as a species, both in terms of our health and the performance of our living systems. So if we're going to head in this direction of reconciling our relationship with the ecosystems we inhabit, we need some ways to measure success. So this is actually Janine Benyus, who I mentioned earlier, and she has founded an organization called the Biomimicry Institute, which is an organization that empowers people to create nature-inspired solutions for a healthier planet. She's got a great website called asknature.org where you can put in, you can ask it any question like, how does nature regulate temperature? And it will give you some, you know, a case study of a jackrabbit's ears or a homeostatic facade system that someone's developed that expands and contracts when it's hit with sunlight to control the temperature inside the building. So Janine talks about the success metrics that biologists use. And for them, it's not about what you do today. It's about what you make possible today. So they think much longer term than we typically do. They talk about the adjacent possible, the adaptations that can only happen when something else has happened before. So like the classic example is that when plants figured out a way to metabolize carbon dioxide and give off oxygen, that was the adjacent, humanity was the thing that was the adjacent possible from that. So these things can, or mammals in general, can be massive, massive changes that come about, but they take a really long time sometimes in biologists' language. She also talks about not just to learn about your place, but learn from your place, and that when you're thinking about making interventions into systems, which is basically what property development is, that we need to ask ourselves, what would nature do here? What would nature not do here? Why? What are the emergent properties of this system? What would I choose to enable and support in the interventions that I make? What would I make possible in this place? Because our choices about what we say we value in these places might make some really fantastic things possible. She talked about an essential system characteristic of nature as being generosity. How does life create more opportunities for life? Our urban areas should function like a rainforest, with that sort of level of sophistication and integration of a huge variety of individual species types. That cities should give back as much or more in terms of the ecosystem services they provide as the native ecosystem they have replaced. So we're talking about things like water collection and purification, carbon sequestration, soil creation, erosion protection. There's 22 of these services that we should think about making sure we maintain or enhance. For example, there's a Bank of America building that emits air that's three times cleaner as the air that goes in. So the technology exists to do these things, and entire cities should and could function in this way. So when we talk about how we signal to the market what we want, we use codes, we use frameworks, and that sort of stuff. And as buildings move towards code compliance on the left, towards what we're trying to get to on the right, which is truly restorative, regenerative outcomes. So the space below the curve is the negative impact, and the costs for the kind of benefits we're looking for are seen as externalities. But what we're trying to say is that if we start talking about these things in terms of integrated value, then they actually are seen as providing an economic benefit, and you'll get past that investment barrier where you look at, if you were to monetize, say, you know, cultural diversity or beauty or land use or water cycles or things like that, so the bits in green on that chart, it is a true triple bottom line measure, some of this stuff starts to actually make economic sense. So I guess what I'm saying is that we need to leverage the ecological and social health sciences to start to assign value to some of these things and monetize them, even though that kind of feels wrong. that's the measure that we make decisions about development with. So this would help the housing market understand what we're asking for them. This would speak to them in their language. Because this is what I think we want, and this is what the Living Building Challenge is all about, is saying that we should reimagine our buildings using the metaphor of a flower. So this is a very, very much a biomimetic sort of idea. So you'd say, okay, a building, like a flower, is rooted in place. It can't move around to get the resources that it needs. But a flower, unlike a building, manages to harvest all of the energy and water it needs. It is perfectly adapted to its climate and site. It operates 100% pollution-free. It's comprised of integrated systems. It is perfectly integrated with the systems around it, and it's beautiful. So, tall order, yes. Very high bar, yes. But just to give you a quick idea, this framework, the Living Building Challenge, has been around since 2008, and we already have 331 projects that are pursuing this standard. There are 9 registered in Australia. There are 2 that are built and 1 that is this close to getting its certification. So these things are absolutely possible. And we sort of, the sort of slope of that curve, I think, will hockey stick fairly soon, because as soon as people can see examples, they're a whole lot more confident about doing it themselves. And the other thing is that if there are 331 people who are working on it together, and then they all suddenly start to take over, those examples suddenly proliferate, and everybody can see them, and everybody goes, okay, wow. So it's kind of like the Roger Bannister thing, you know, that nobody can run a mile in under 4 minutes. Roger Bannister does it, and then the record stands for, what, like 41 days? And then by the end of that year, I can't remember how many other runners who had done it, but it just was gone. And the current standard is like 20 seconds faster than that. So it's just, there's just that we're only limited by what we think. So just to talk to you a little bit about how the Living Building Challenge works, it's a framework that's based on performance outcomes rather than anticipated outcomes. So you demonstrate that you've achieved these requirements by showing us your energy bills rather than showing us modeling. So you have to demonstrate 12 months of continuous operation in accordance with the standard in order to get certified. You can apply it at any scale, really. You can do a part of a building, so you can just do a renovation. You can do it for infrastructure, so a bridge or a road, potentially. Or you can do it in buildings. In keeping with the metaphor of the flower, the categories of the Living Building Challenge are divided into petals. So we have 7 petals that address place, water, energy, health and happiness, materials, equity, and beauty. So it's meant to be a completely holistic framework, and you don't, to get recognition, you don't have to achieve all the requirements. You can get partial certifications, what we call petal certification. But the idea, of course, is that you would get all 20 of these imperatives in your building. So the simple ones are water and energy, where we ask you to be net positive, because nature doesn't do zero. Nature does generous. Nature does more. And then for place, we're looking at, where do you choose to build? making sure that you include some food production in that, making sure you make provision for the other species you've displaced, and making it so that people can get to and from it under human power, so maybe cycling or walking. For health, we're looking at having a healthy indoor environment. You have access to fresh air and daylight, and that the principles of biophilia are included in the design to give you that sort of happy brain space that you need. For materials, we want to cover absolutely everything from the raw material extraction to the end of life of the material. We want everything to be non-toxic. We want it to be net positive at every stage of its life cycle. So you're addressing both the manufacturer as well as the use of the product and its what happens to it at the end of its life, preferably not disposal. For equity and beauty, these are sort of categories that so far have not been addressed in these kinds of frameworks, but if you know we want a positive future, we think these are really critical aspects. So equity looks at making sure that our buildings are scaled for us, not cars and airplanes, and that our environments are scaled for us, not just our buildings, that everyone has the ability to access your building, whether you know they have any physical limitations, or and there's no gated communities are not socially equitable in our opinion, so we don't want to see that. That you make some provision in your project to make charitable donation to the cause of your choice, and that some of your organizations are participating in our JUST label, which is a social justice label for performance of organizations. So you're being transparent about how you're performing against a number of indicators, including things like gender equity and work-life balance and stuff like that. And finally, we really think that in order for things to be truly sustainable, they need to be beautiful and they need to be inspiring, because we take care of the things that we love, and nature's seduction trick is to get you to love them by being beautiful. So, flowers and all sort of stuff. So, and we have this wonderful tradition of craft and art, and it shouldn't be relegated to museums. We should have beauty in our daily lives. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to make sure that we deliberately consider that in the building. So it's not that you get rated like a beauty contest, like do we think it's beautiful? It's did you consider it? Did you deliberately include things in the design of your building that celebrate the local culture and the local place and are there just to be delightful? And then inspiration and education is about letting as many people as possible experience your building. So if you're an office or, like the Sustainable Buildings Research Center at the University of Wollongong is the building that's like this close. And so part of their requirement will be to hold an open house once a year and let everybody come through and have a look and give guided tours and explain to people how the building works. Because we want these ideas to proliferate as quickly as possible. So we want to make sure that people can access the case studies on the website, but if they want to go and experience the building and really see what it's like, they have the opportunity to do that too. We do sort of also want people to think about where they build. So we've divided the projects into transects, and they go from natural habitat preserve, which would be a place where we'd really prefer you didn't build at all, unless it was like, we might make an exception for an interpretive center or something like that, in which case we'd insist that you that you do living building challenge, all the way through to urban core. And generally the idea is that we would like to see increasing densification and better infill use of the spaces that we've already appropriated, and try and free up some of the other spaces that we haven't quite compromised yet for food production and to return to others as viable habitat. Another concept to think about is scale jumping. So these requirements obviously include infrastructure. And sometimes the scale of a particular piece of infrastructure on a single project site just does not work. It's not optimal. So maybe it's not optimal economically, maybe it's not optimal functionally. So if that's the case, we allow you to go outside your project's boundary And maybe you get your neighbors to go in on you with a solar array or some sort of water treatment system so that everybody benefits. And that's completely fine with us. In fact, we kind of think that's awesome. So, and speaking of infrastructure, I wanted to talk about this project in addition to some of the case studies that I'll go through for actual houses that you might live in, because these sort of systems are going to be part of this where we live and future as well. And this building, the Omega Center, is a wastewater treatment facility. And it basically covers, it addresses all of the wastewater for the Omega Center campus, and it does it with living machines. So it's turns into such a lovely interior environment that people actually use it as a yoga studio, which was not an intended program use of this space, as you can imagine. But it demonstrates that on-site treatment of raw sewage can be a beautiful, cost-effective, integrated facility that you don't have to have 25 miles down the road so that you don't have to look at it. It's right there on campus, and here's an interior shot, so you can see all of the various tanks and all the plants that are treating all of the effluent. And there's your folks doing yoga in a beautiful daylit environment, and a highly oxygenated environment too, I would imagine. And here's another interesting piece of infrastructure for you. So this is the Beacon Food Forest. It's a 2.8-hectare food development in an inner suburb of Seattle. And it's, I think, a great idea of how a values-based project can have social as well as ecological benefits. So the folks that are involved get the satisfaction of growing food. They get the connections between people within a community. They get the connections between generations within that community. The food forest is entirely community-run. And the experts, which are basically only people that have come there one time more than you, wear yellow bandanas, and everyone is welcome to help. And if they have a question, they know that the people with the yellow bandanas are the one to go ask. And in addition, everyone is welcome to harvest. So all of the food that's produced here is free. Anybody who wants to come and take it can take it. Now, it's not your average community garden, though. A food forest is actually a holistic land management system that's based on the natural systems of the forest. So it incorporates trees, shrubs, and perennial plants in a way that mimics the structure and beneficial relationships that you would find in an actual natural ecosystem. So it turns out to be an incredibly resilient, low-cost, low-maintenance strategy for a public park that produces food. So that would be, you know, a great piece of infrastructure to have outside your front door. All right, so this first house, and sorry about the image quality there, it's kind of hard to see, but this is a little home in Austin, Texas. It's 200 square meters, and it's called the Willowbrook House. And all of these case studies are available on the International Living Future Institute's website. So if you want to look at better quality pictures, or, you know, pictures with the lights off, just Google Willowbrook House or Google Living Building Challenge case studies, and this page will come up for you. Now, the owner of this house designed and remodeled this home with the primary goal of providing his family with an inspiring and comfortable place to live. And he really wanted to reduce the impact of his family lifestyle on the land and the community that they live in, which is a very typical Austin kind of thing. You know, it's like a whole city of Newtown, if you've ever been there. Yeah. So Nathan, who's the owner of the house, wanted to achieve net zero energy, but he really didn't think that he'd be able to do it. He was redeveloping an existing house that was built in 1948, and so he just kind of thought, I don't know if this is possible, and he didn't want to substantially alter the character of the house because it's in a fairly well-established neighborhood, and he didn't want it to sort of not fit in with that overall character. So he built the addition, he remodeled the existing house, and he managed to still retain the existing character and give it a few personal craft touches that unfortunately you can't really see in this photo. And there's some lovely stairs within the house that actually combine, oh yeah, that's much better, thank you, that combine the use of two very prevalent trees in Texas, so pine and pecan. And he sort of alternated them for the tread and the riser up these stairs. Just kind of a nice little touch, particularly since he personally spent much of his childhood in Vermont chopping firewood for the wood stove. So there's a real deep connection for him. And in that house, he also hand-pumped water from a well. So he really feels like having a home designed that sort of requires you to tend to it and care for it. It was something that was a goal for him, even though he knows that that might be something that most people wouldn't be interested in. He feels like it's a relationship between him and the house. So he looks after the house, and the house provides shelter and comfort for his family in return. So he pays attention to the weather 2 or 3 days out. So he figures out whether or not it'd be a good idea to open the windows or keep them closed so that he can heat or cool the thermal mass as required. He also talks about in his case study about how he checks whether or not it's going to rain so that he knows whether or not to do a load of laundry and hang it out to dry, which I think is kind of funny because I do that here. So it's so normal in Australia to do that, whereas in the States everybody still really uses the washer dryer. I think the thing that he's really going for, which I find really poetic, is that he's looking for ways to connect with the nature around him, weather and everything else, so that his house, it feels like, he must be a sailor at heart, or he was a sailor in a past life, that he wants to trim the sails, and he wants to really have the sense of the boat moving in the water in response to the wind, rather than strapping an outboard motor on the back and just going for it. So that one I spoke to me. This one is a little bit closer to home. This is the Zero Energy Home in Auckland, New Zealand. And again, it's a 200 square meter home. It's made up of two blocks. So there's a living block and a work block. So they're towards the back. And it's a very archetypal barn kind of form for a house. So it's, again, it's not a sort of a challenging, strange looking thing. The wood, which is, I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, Macrocarpa, which is a native wood for that area, is used a lot, but it's usually painted. So they left it unpainted so that it could be expressed and you could see it. The steel roof, again, is very typical. You can't really see in this photograph, but that slightly bumped up edge is the solar array. And the angle of the roof was deliberately chosen so that it was the optimum angle for the solar panels, and it didn't sort of look like a stuck-on, add-on thing, because the family thought that was kind of visually unappealing. So they found a way around that. Okay, and then this is just a nice sort of interior shot of the kitchen and the concrete floor, which provides the thermal mass to help regulate the temperature in what's largely a fairly open plan space. And then this is the work block, which has basically that whole wall is translucent material, so really lovely sort of no glare, just nice bright daylight for whatever they decide they want to do in there. It looks like woodworking for the most part. And then finally, I thought we'd look at a slightly different typology. So this is an infill project in San Francisco. And this is a 66 square meter house over a 40 square meter workshop. And it also pairs with, there's an existing Edwardian townhome that between the three buildings sort of creates a bit of a mixed-use complex. So it's got some cultural and commercial and residential uses on a very compact lot. So it's a typical-sized neighborhood lot. And the solar array on the roof produces roughly twice the amount of the energy the house actually uses. And the reason that they were able to do that is because they used the passive house standard to get a really efficient envelope. So this is a classic example of, I will look at the energy budget that I have available to me on the site, and I will design the house to fit within that budget rather than design the house and then, oh, how much energy do I need? And they looked at what their biggest energy footprint was going to be. And so in San Francisco, they figured it's going to be heating. And so they tried to mitigate that as much as possible first, and then it obviously took care of itself, so they produce far more than they use. The cottage also uses a lot of salvaged and reused materials, so there was some framing members that were taken from an existing shed structure on the site, which were then used as the custom cabinetry in the kitchen, and the wood factory flooring was salvaged to from another project, actually, was salvaged for the floors. And they also didn't treat the floors with anything that had any VOCs, just flaxseed oil. So it's kind of keeps the texture, and it actually naturally seals it. So it does extend its life, but just doesn't have that gloss that sort of fakes. It still looks very much like wood. And the same wood flooring was treated on the outside as charred, which is sort of black squares there. And apparently charring is a durable, maintenance-free finish that is resistant to pets and rot, which I didn't realize. So nice, very nice use of salvaged materials in the building envelope as well, with those metal shingles that have been allowed to sort of patina as a rust. And this mural was already in place, so they sort of built around it to incorporate it onto opening onto a common courtyard. So they really tried to kind of connect to the urban fabric that was already there with the project that they've added. So if it seems like I'm showing you examples of places that look a lot like places we already live in, good. Because I think, sometimes residential architecture, people find that maybe they're just, they might be quite bold in other aspects of their life, but when it comes to their residential architecture, they get a bit conservative. And so having buildings that look a bit weird and wild and wonderful really doesn't appeal to lots and lots of people. But at least in the three examples we've showed, I think it's demonstrating that these sorts of principles do not limit the aesthetics of what you're trying to do. So you could have a very normal-looking house that achieves these requirements, or you could have a completely crazy-looking house that achieves these requirements. And that what it's really about is the higher level of awareness and care that goes into thinking about how they fit into their place, how they integrate into their place, how they give back to their place and contribute to where they've been built. Because at the end of the day, we are part of this spectacular place. Whether we live in an apartment or a townhome or a detached house, whether we own it or rent it, all these models might change as we move into the future. But we're part of this rare and fragile ecosystem that is part of who we are, part of how we introduce ourselves. We're Australians. We live in this place, and we should look after it, and it will look after us. So I'll just leave you with a quote from James Ellis. "For anyone who may be tempted to chase these dreams, never doubt that your vision can happen. Bridges of community can be built over all the roadblocks and ditches. We are, after all, neighbors who care about each other and have learned to love the same place." Thank you very much.